making me unsafe. He was throwing me away. He was the dean, and he was respected. He was the politician everyone loved. He knew I was fragile at this school and was trying to regain my footing. Now I would have to play along untruthfully. I didn't know what to do, so I might have giggled when I ran out of the room and promptly passed out in the vestibule right outside the dean's office. Chip happened to be coming out from a class down the hall. He saw me and helped me up. In the safety of Chip's car, I told him what happened. I wanted an ally. Chip believed me. He saw the dean's favoritism and how it was possible. Chip became a good part of that story. He kept the peace. He was friendly to this man, who was my mentor, but I knew he was always looking out for me. He didn't do much, but it was enough. He waited for me outside the dean's door as often as he could after that. I felt sad. I loved the dean, but not as a lover. And he had dealt a huge blow. I had no designs on grown men. I needed the dean for so much more than a sexual awakening. I needed him to help me learn to be in this world. I needed him to help me succeed academically to thrive. I needed to do better in school so I could stay at Cranbrook. I felt shattered. I didn't understand anything. I was angry. My grades continued to fall. I lost my way. I fell apart. It was later that spring that I was told I would not be invited to return to Cranbrook for my sophomore year. I was devastated. It was the dean who lobbied for me to be readmitted, and he prevailed. It was in part because of him that I was given a second chance. Despite his transgressions, he did fight for me. He was my ally, except when he wasn't. That's why it hurt to discover the dean was just a regular man. It was a sad awakening. Adults are just like you, but older. For the rest of my time at Cranbrook, I did what I could to avoid being alone with the dean. But in order to stay in my beloved school, I was under a contract to meet with him every day. I was in a bad spot. He kept trying to find me, taking me out of class, seeking me out. He was one of the most important men at the school, and I knew I could not refuse him outright. Sometimes when we were together, he tried to hold my hand or kiss me. Nothing ever happened again, but I still felt it could. I never felt safe. I was the mature one, the one to make sure we were never alone together for any extended period of time. I became cagey, laughing and deflecting and making jokes, distracting. All the while, I would pray, please, just let me get through this year. Still, I never told him to stop. Cranbrook had taught me so much, offered me a whole new vocabulary, and yet I didn't know how to say those two simple words. Please, stop. Please, stop. Are there two more important words in this world? Please, stop. Are there two words that are harder to say when you're a woman in a position like this? Every time I tried to get out of the room, I tried not to engage. But I never asked him to stop. I didn't want to consider what the consequences might be if I refused him. Saying no to him meant losing Cranbrook, and I didn't want to lose Cranbrook. One night early in my senior year, my mother and I were lying in her bed. She was reading a Robertson Davies novel. I leaned into her shoulder. Apropos of nothing, she closed her book and said, "I think the dean is in love with you." She paused. "Is he?" I was overcome. I took a slow, deep breath, exhaled, and said, "I think he might be. He tried to kiss me." My mother exhaled and said, "I knew it." She took a deep breath. "You must not tell anybody. He's beloved at that school, and you'll just be a troubled girl. Best to get through and get done." I knew she was right in saying this. I put my head on the pillow. I would evade. I would get out. I had done the right thing in confiding in her, and she would not embarrass me and make me react in any public way. My former ally was now an enemy of my ever-loyal mother. "I'm sorry," she said, her focus far off. My mother and I didn't speak of the dean again. I did as she instructed and stayed quiet. But at the end of my senior year, on the night of my baccalaureate, he came over to speak to me. He congratulated me for winning a writing award and told me he was so proud of me. I was still holding the book I'd received in recognition, a hardcover collection of short stories engraved with the words, "To Blair Beitner, the 1990 Strickland Writing Award, in recognition of her passionate commitment to, joy in, and success at creative writing." I clutched it over my chest. Armor. Then he turned to my mother and said, "And you must be so proud of Selma, too." She stared at him, but didn't say anything. She didn't even crack a smile. She just looked at him, stone-faced. Then, "I know what you did. Stay away from my daughter." He walked away. I graduated the next day. When I was a freshman at Kalamazoo College and felt worlds away from the dean, a call came in from him out of the blue. I was in my dorm room. I don't remember how the conversation began. I had five roommates crowding near, waiting to go out together. But I do remember him telling me, "I need to apologize for what I did. I am so sorry, Selma." I breezily said, "Oh, it's okay." I hung up the phone. Then I went in the bathroom and threw up. 2 years later, a girl approached me on campus and asked, "What happened with the dean? My mother is friends with his wife. She said she's furious with you. You ruined their marriage." That broke my heart. I'd never have the chance to explain his transgression. There was no winning. I was the mean baby, the girl who had ruined this house. I was surprised that an adult I loved, thought I was culpable. I was surprised she couldn't see the truth, that the dean had ruined me. I still think about what happened, how handsome the dean was, in his suede elbow-patched tweed coats over cashmere sweaters, how he was seen as so fair and great, how I chose him as my father figure because he allowed and encouraged me to. I think about how it all seemed on the up and up. He didn't rape me. He was too old school, old guard, and careful. What is so horrible to me, what hurt me then and now, what damages and hurts the scores of women who have been in similar situations, was that he extended the invitation to a vulnerable girl, that he dared to test out the waters, knowing full well I believed he was there for me, in my corner, as a trusted champion, friend, and mentor. It took tremendous strength to see the situation for what it really was. To my 14-year-old brain, I was sensitive and lost, and I wanted to trust someone. This man represented the sum total of what I thought I wanted someday. I wanted to grow up and find a man who was just like the dean, to be a wife who was just like his wife. But his predation changed me. It was an insult to everything I learned to believe in. I learned that this man, so beloved, was not, at least not entirely, who everyone believed him to be. I learned that when it came to marriage, I did not have much to look forward to. I learned that the people in charge do not always have your best interests at heart. Remarkably, my dealings with the dean did not diminish my total awe and love for the rest of my Cranbrook experience. If anything, I built Cranbrook into a transcendent place. It was remarkable, and it was beautiful and otherworldly. But I made it into a full-blown fairy tale, maybe to compensate for how shattered I was by the actions of a grown man. But the institution of Cranbrook still saved me from my basement. More than anything, Cranbrook is where I was exposed to great works of literature beyond the books I'd discovered on my mother's shelves. I loved books, just as my mother had always loved books. But Cranbrook gave me a vocabulary. Words, I discovered, are the salve for curiosity. Words are the connection, linking me to everyone else, to all the people before and since. Words were a discovery. Threads of humanity, connecting us across time and place. Words were my saving grace. The surroundings of Cranbrook made every book even more heartbreaking or winsome. The first book I studied in 9th grade was The Catcher in the Rye, taught by my young teacher who looked like a Salinger character himself, in his L.L. Bean moccasins and wool socks. The Scarlet Letter, The Odyssey, The Turn of the Screw, Invisible Man, and the works of C.S. Lewis and James Joyce. If my house were to catch fire, the two things I would save are my son and my first edition of Till We Have Faces, gifted by a dear friend. I preferred the tragic tales then, the sorrows of young Werther, the end of the affair. Oh, that book broke my heart open. The Wanderer, by the doomed French novelist Hélène Fournier, in which the main character is ruined by his passion for an unattainable girl found in a fairy tale estate in the woods. I fancied myself a chain-smoking writer, living in a garret and writing poems like Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes. We also read plays and short stories by Henrik Ibsen and James Joyce, Shakespeare and Homer and Morrison. I learned that Raymond Carver said he didn't write long stories because he didn't have the endurance. Oh, I thought, you can use your laziness to your advantage. You can use your lack of focus and still create something beautiful. At Hillel, we learned from the Torah. Our main Hebrew text was the Talmud. They were laws and they were profound, but they weren't personal to me. At Cranbrook, the canon of literature they chose all felt so personal. An intimate conversation between writer and reader. It could be playful, easy, and sometimes confounding. To me, Cranbrook was a secret garden. Meeting so much literature in that setting, where everything felt so timeless, I found the thing that sang to me. Books would save my life. I saw how they cracked me open in the best way, pushed tears out or made me laugh with the fart that did fly in the Canterbury Tales. I learned how it feels when someone else's thoughts touch a part of you that you haven't felt before. Books are a great emotional lifesaver, a nightlight, a doormat. Even if you're stuck in a hospital or in line at the DMV, it's all okay if you have a good book with you. Books also taught me how to notice things, how a moment can be a whole story. I notice everything these days. The dust bunnies swirling into far corners, the long blades of grass living between the cracks in the sidewalk, the way my son flares his nostrils. These things, if you stop and take note, remind you that you're alive, make you feel that you still count. They silence all the worries for a moment. By the time I was a young adult, I was just starting to arrive at that point where distance made one wiser. I wanted a permanent record, something to prove I once existed, something to hold on to. These books moved me, their words so beautiful that they became a part of me. I wanted to stay inside them forever. But my hero was Joan Didion, whose work I devoured, Slouching Towards Bethlehem, Play It As It Lays, The White Album. I related to her aloofness, the refuge she sought in words. I read and reread her, dazzled by her brilliant mind and understated style. Her whole presentation thrilled me. I felt so pleased that, like her, I kept journals all my life. Keepers of private notebooks are a different breed altogether, lonely and resistant rearrangers of things, anxious malcontents, children afflicted apparently at birth with some presentiment of loss. It was as if she were speaking straight to me. If Didion was my idol, my English teacher, James Toner, was my first real life mentor. The only person I'd ever met who had actually published stories in literary journals. I worshipped him, as a bonus, he didn't want anything from me, other than for me to keep reading and writing. I entered Mr. Toner's class as if I were walking into his church. For the first time, I was allowed to be seen as a person growing into a writer. It was a far cry from Hillel, where the girls were not even encouraged to study in the same way the boys were. Mr. Toner taught me that literature could be a salve. He nurtured my yearning to be a writer. The very first short story I wrote was for Mr. Toner's class, and my mother served as my editor. "Selma," she said, her red pen slashing, "this is very Rococo." But she had an eye for it. Ever the storyteller, she would find a good sentence and then build a simple narrative out of it. Somehow, without really adding a word of her own, she could turn a story into something great. I am a procrastinator of writing essays. I saw this in school. They were too structured, too focused. You had to map it out. You had to outline. You had to be clear. Whenever I began to write, I thought, who the hell knows where it's going? I wanted to force the words out. But in Mr. Toner's class, I discovered that writing could be so many things. I felt the power in the pages. He helped open up the possibilities. I wanted to be someone. I wanted to create something, too. In my dreams, I wanted James Toner to someday teach my words to other kids who felt shut down and needed a key out. Oh, I wanted to be seen. I wanted to run into the hills like white elephants and come out a writer. Instantly. We girls knew that my parents didn't have the sort of commitment to each other that would go the distance happily. And so I was not surprised when one day I came home after visiting an Ohio college with Sue, junior year, and found my mother alone on the chaise in her sitting room, a cigarette in one hand and a book open on her lap. "He's gone," she said, without a trace of emotion. My father had moved out. My mother didn't make a big deal of it, and neither did I. Elliot had left and never lived on Coventry Woods Lane again. He rented apartments and furniture, as if the split were temporary. They finally divorced when I was 23 and never spoke to each other again. My relationship with Elliot was never going to build after the day he moved out. I chose a side, and I chose my mother. My literary ambitions took a major detour in my senior year when my first foray into acting was made. Ironically, the whole thing was James Toner's idea. I was struggling mightily with Shakespeare. I didn't care for verse and didn't find my way into his plays. This was, Toner thought, a deficiency in my education. He recommended I audition for the school play, As You Like It. Perhaps on stage, I would embrace Shakespeare's brilliance as a playwright. My audition went so badly, I didn't even get a callback. I was dreadful. The text fell from my hands. I was unable to find my place. I continued auditioning at Mr. Toner's urging and was rejected again. Finally, I tried one last time for a student-directed production and was cast as a lead in T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral. The play was not great in our hands, interminable and boring as hell. At intermission, much of the audience fled, including my mother, although she did comment that I looked gorgeous in my stage makeup and that I should keep it on indefinitely. Looking down from the stage, I intuited we were losing our momentum and resorted to every trick I could think of to keep the fidgety audience engaged. I could have turned the performance into a burlesque show. The show must go on. It didn't matter what show. By the end, there were only a few listless souls remaining in the auditorium. To my dread, James Toner was one of them. Mortifying. I wanted to melt into the stage. I couldn't believe he'd witnessed such a boring calamity. I felt certain I'd fallen several rungs in his esteem. After we took our bows, I sheepishly made my way over to him. "Blair," he exclaimed, "you're an actress." I was quiet, crushed. I wanted him to see me as a writer, but he was unequivocal. His words played in my head. "You're an actress." The power of a label yet again. At least I had more options now. Later that night, I took a walk in the woods. Deep in the trees on Cranbrook's campus, there's a statue of Zeus's head, a kind of mantelpiece in a clearing. And if you stand on the right spot, tears fall from his eyes. I stood there alone, waiting for Zeus's tears. Mr. Toner's words replayed over and over in my mind. I wasn't a writer. I was an actress. I did not yet think that one could be both a writer and an actress, or that I had the power to set my own course, not an overachiever, or even much of an achiever, but I had been given another prophecy, and it was my destiny to fulfill it. Part 2, Questions. Kalamazoo. Because of my early academic struggles at Cranbrook, I didn't have a strong enough GPA or SAT score to get into the University of Michigan, where Katie and Mimi had gone. So I won a partial scholarship to study photography at Kalamazoo College, a small liberal arts school a few hours from home. I didn't think any school would ever compare with Cranbrook, so I never gave the lovely ivy-covered Kalamazoo a chance. From the day I arrived on campus, I was a recluse. I worked hard enough, spending hours every week in the photography lab or typing poems at my word processor. I didn't try to make friends. My suite mates were a decent group of misfits, but we never grew close. When I wasn't in class, I drank, but so did everyone. I grew dangerously depressed and despairing, away from the reign of my mother, so lonely. I felt lost and adrift, grateful for the wine coolers, beer, and fancy Godiva liqueur I kept in my room. My English professor, Conrad Hilberry, an accomplished writer and a wonderful older man, became an appropriate mentor. He was elegant, with a wide grin and a big laugh, and legs that kept crossing and uncrossing. He was also quite thin. If he turned sideways, his glasses appeared thicker than his torso. His class gathered in an airy room, like my Cranbrook days. We sat around a table and read our work aloud. We talked about Arthur Ashe, of whom we were all great fans, and who was honored with the tennis courts in his name. He introduced me to the works of Charles Simic, Sharon Olds, John Donne, Joan Didion, Truman Capote. He was so pleased whenever the word would sing. When I was a freshman in college, he told me to keep writing. So I wrote only poems because I was still too unsure to put more words down on paper. Words that made sense anyway. Recently, I came across one. Martini Olive. You started with the asking that summer. Honey, will you hand me the lemon rinds? My little hands willingly felt past the warm milk and mushy avocados. Peculiar how you were so happy in the day, buying limes, stirrers, and olives, orange pimento caught inside that firm green flesh. Strange to think I came out of you, like the inside of an olive, as soft and as slippery. But on the front porch, watching the mosquitoes, you never mentioned it. Night would buzz down. The glasses were still now, but only that summer. Later is a different day. Before bed, your asking brought me running, sliding on the pickled oak floor. Summer, and you were afraid of dying in the tub. Naked, undignified, you called it. And that made me cry. Somehow, silently, my nose pressed against plaster. I waited for you outside our little bathroom while you undid yourself and soaked. I listened for the clink of glasses or the smell of a martini that reminded me of the geraniums we planted. I imagined you floating down, bloating with water like a martini olive, sponging up the gin. Conrad Hilberry died in 2017. I miss him. He sent word once in a blue moon and continued to be a supportive presence in my life until I left for California. He encouraged me to dig deeper. Let yourself be provoked. Don't be afraid to get agitated. he said. What if I don't have anything to say? I would ask him. Just keep searching, he'd respond. He always urged another story, a closer look. I think he knew how much he meant to me. I hope he did. When I was a freshman at Kalamazoo, I started dating Jason K., a pretty boy who lived upstairs in the dorms. He was a catch in that college boy way, easily cuter than anyone else there. One night, we rode the bus into Kalamazoo for dinner and a movie, and he kissed me. For months, I walked the stairwell to his small and cozy room, where I was greeted by the scent of his Calvin Klein Eternity cologne and the glow of the Christmas lights strung above his bed. We tried, very sweetly, to make ours a love story. But we weren't cut from the same cloth. He didn't really fancy me deeply, a fact that became evident soon enough. He typed up a list of all the things he thought I needed to change about myself. How to fix Blair. I took up with another handsome fellow, Todd, a trainer at the barn where I rode for PE credit. We fell in love. But one night he told me he didn't love me anymore and that he wanted to break up. Devastated, I waited for him to fall asleep. Then I went into his closet, sat down on the brown marble shag carpeting, and decided my life was not worth living. Tucked among his clothing, I took a full bottle of extra strength Tylenol, which I got down with half a bottle of tequila. Then I closed my eyes and waited. I don't think I wanted to die in that moment. I just didn't want to be in pain anymore. AKA, alive. I believed I was unlovable. I wanted to go to sleep and maybe I could wake up as someone else, someone right. As I was about to pass out, I had regret. I woke up Todd and showed him what I had done. He found his mom upstairs and she called poison control. They drove me to the nearest hospital. In the ER, they gave me a supersized charcoal slushy, the consistency of blended Oreo cookies. I couldn't keep it down, retching violently. So the nurses pumped my stomach. The large tube they threaded through my nostrils broke my nose, but sucked out most of the offending acetaminophen. I had diarrhea in the bedpan. By morning, I was released. Blair's goals. Roman numeral 1. Gain 5 pounds in muscle. A. Run. B. Eat good foods. C. Stretches and aerobics before bed. Roman numeral 2. Stay at K for this year. A. Don't let Jason make me miss class. B. Can't get stoned more than once a month. C. Asterisk. Learn to use Mac. D. Schedule time wisely. E. Study for at least 3 to 4 hours after dinner. F. Run Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, 2:30 to 3:30. Roman numeral 3. Learn to be independent. A. Avoid Tony and express your true feelings to him, even if it may hurt him. B. Asterisk. Don't push away Jason's friendship. C. Asterisk. Don't get into another relationship until counseling with Jason. D. Get out of your mom's back pocket. 1. Call only once a week unless absolutely necessary. Then must ask Jason if you can. 2. Express to your mom when she upsets you and don't take everything so hard. 3. Asterisk. Think for yourself and about what's good for you, and don't worry about anyone else. Roman numeral 4. Don't be an alcoholic. A. Blair can only drink 3 times a week, maximum of 8 drinks at a time. You can only drink the maximum once a week. I have read the above arrangement and have agreed to the terms of it and understand certain consequences that may entail due to the abuse of this agreement, signed, Selma Blair Beitner. I didn't say a word about it to anyone until months later, when I confessed to my father, who forced me to tell my mother before she saw it on the insurance bill. Over the phone, she calmly told me, "You are dead to me. How could you have done that to me?" I held the receiver to my ear and held back fat tears as my suite mates looked over. I thought she understood who I was. I thought she understood everything. So angry was she that we didn't speak much for 2 years. Todd, however, took me back, and we stayed together until I left for University of Michigan, and then New York City. Aside from Conrad Hilberry, the other bright spot of my time at Kalamazoo was that I finally had the space to pursue my childhood passion for riding horses. They offered riding for a gym credit, and I immediately enrolled. I was pleased to discover that somehow I was okay at it, a pretty enough rider. My body had learned more, I thought, and this time I was ready to ride. That's how I met Todd. I noticed a trainer who was gorgeous in his riding outfit. He had a natural way with horses, and I wasn't surprised to learn he'd been riding since he could walk. He taught me how to jump. He taught me proper form. We spent frigid days watering horses and dropping hay bales in stables. For 2 years, I kept riding and jumping. It was like a time-lapse sequence in a movie, where I worked at it daily, blundered, and prevailed, and eventually, I progressed into a decent rider. Practically, this meant that if I got on a good horse, I'd win a couple ribbons. If I got on a horse that wasn't so good, I'd fall. I didn't show a tremendous amount of promise, but I was obsessed. My daydream was to be like Tatum O'Neill in International Velvet. I wanted to be a good rider, and like any actress, I also wanted to look the part. The style part I could manage. Ordering a hot dog and Diet Coke at a horse show, I looked like a serious contender. But when it came time to ride, it was anybody's guess. Where other girls would cry when they fell off, I would laugh it off, get back up, and finish the course. Everyone thought I had such a good attitude, but really, I was just a mediocre rider who was pleased to get to ride instead of watching my sister. My mom only opted to view one horse show. She was very disappointed in the dusty ring in Kalamazoo. "Where's my mint julep?" she asked. If my mom had to be somewhere she didn't want to be, there had better be a cocktail. Otherwise, she wasn't coming back. One and done. I'm sure she had a good book with her to get through. Where riding brought me joy, it also caused pain. I broke bones, including my lower back. I crushed half my face in a bad fall. After college, when I left Michigan to pursue acting, I put it behind me. I left showing, I left the injuries, I left the dream of opening up a barn with Todd, but I never really left my love of riding. It would be waiting for me to return someday, when I was ready. I once stole a pair of jeans from the college laundry room. I didn't intend to. I was carrying my clothes back to my room when I saw a green pair of jeans crumpled in the pile. I didn't have a pair of green Guess jeans. They definitely weren't mine. But I made no attempt to return them. 3 years later, I rented a bright red summer term house with a girl named Tammy. I wore those jeans all summer long. And it turned out they had been hers. By that point, I'd forgotten about it. She never said a word to me, but later, she told a boyfriend that she knew I stole her jeans. Cringy. Even though they were not particularly flattering, I remember feeling really solid in those jeans because they felt like a hand-me-down from someone who wasn't my family. Meanwhile, the whole summer long, she thought she was living with a thief and said nothing to me. I wish she had told me. I would have said, "Oh my God, these are yours? Here, I'll give them back to you right now." And off they would go, returned safe and sound. I would have told her my side of the story and made it right. But she didn't have the same casual outlook on thievery that I had. I'm still embarrassed about it. There's surely someone out there saying, "Selma Blair, from Cruel Intentions, she stole my jeans." I want you to know, Tammy, I've thought about you a lot. I was an ass, but only a one-time thief of jeans. I'm sorry. Over the years, I've come to find that it means something big to have something of someone else's. Having another person's possessions feels a bit like love, a sharing. Maybe it started when I stole Marla's purple nail polish in fourth grade. Once I'd swiped it, I could never wear it because then she'd know I had it. I just liked keeping it at home because it belonged to Marla, a small way of keeping her close. I didn't tell her and felt guilty. I still do, for all the things I did wrong. Of course, stealing things from people is, in fact, not an act of love. But I've discovered you can ask them. I stole a shirt from my high school boyfriend, Chip, well into our adult years. I went right into his closet and took it. I told him about it after the fact. The next day, it reminded me of you and I wanted to have it. He was very unfazed by it, in a very cool way, and he said I could keep it. So, I'm still a bit of a thief, I guess, but now, at least, I go about it in a more kosher way. He told me to ask next time. Copy that. My junior year, I transferred to the University of Michigan. A chance for a fresh college start. Still, I didn't stop drinking. I couldn't. Alcohol was too much a part of me, a part of college life, a necessary emotional sustenance, as essential as air. I became anxious and scared if I didn't have a drink come evening. It was my regulator, a way to quiet myself quickly. I drank some before class, I drank after class, I drank all weekend long. I drank alone in my dorm room. I drank in the dark room while developing photographs. I never drank water, only alcohol, wine or gin or whiskey or vodka. I fell down. I threw up. I stood up. I went to class. My drinking grew worse when I befriended the hard-partying sorority girls of Kappa Alpha Theta, who invited me to join them on spring break. The whole group of us drove down to Key West, all the way from Michigan. My dad offered to get me a plane ticket, but I declined. I wanted to have a real college road trip experience. As a solo drinker, I was curious to know what it felt like to be normal and sociable. The day after we arrived at our rental, a few of us went deep sea fishing. It was sunny, humid, and frankly, kind of boring. There was a stocked cooler full of beer, and I made quick work of it. I was so bombed catching barracuda on that boat in the hot Florida sun that I began shamelessly flirting with the first mate. By the time we came ashore, I was dead drunk. Our group ended up at a fancy restaurant for dinner, where I retched in the bathroom nonstop. I could barely make it back to the table without vomiting more. After I discharged a day's worth of sun poisoning and beer, I found the boy from the boat at the club. We went back to his little house, where his tiny bedroom smelled like fish. His work clothes piled in a corner. I knew nothing about him other than his first name, Tom. In a blackout, I started to have sex with him. Right away, he said, "Hey, we need a condom." And those words brought me back. What the fuck was I doing? "Oh, I have to go," I said. "I will call you a cab," he responded courteously. But I needed air. I fled Tom's apartment and ran into the street, but I had no idea how to get back to our rental. I didn't know where I was, that I was miles away. This was before cell phones. I was alone. I stumbled down the sidewalk, trying to find my way back to the house or someone who could take me. The street was pitch black. I sat over by a cropping of trees. That's when two men found me. They held my hands down, kissed me, touched my breasts, laughed with each other. They were very aggressive. They didn't leave bruises, but they hurt me just the same. They flipped me over on my stomach. I don't know if both of them raped me. One of them definitely did. I made myself small and quiet and waited for it to be over. I lied plenty when I was little. But I am not a liar now. I've never accused anyone of anything false. Never spun a tale with details that aren't real. I wish I could say what happened to me that night was an anomaly, an isolated incident, but it wasn't. I didn't think of them as traumas. I have been raped multiple times because I was too drunk to say the words, "Please stop." Only that one time was violent. They were total strangers. It was always awful, and it was always wrong. And I came out of each event quiet and ashamed. Over the course of my youth, this type of thing happened more than I care to recall or admit. Crawling out of bars, waking up bloated and sick in hotel rooms, not remembering how I got there, not understanding what was taking place at the time. It is painful to write these truths, even now. Looking back is the way to move forward, to meet it. There are many plot points I don't remember clearly, so many time frames upon frames lost. I numbed my body and left it an empty shell for the taking. I still don't know a lot of the details, and it's safe to say I never want to. It started the very first time I got drunk at the Passover table and screamed and cried to my cousin Matthew, who was just a kid himself. Even then, when I drank too much, I would look to a male for comfort. In eighth grade, I hung out with a boy from the gas station, drinking and making out in a bathroom stall. As a teenager, I'd drink and wake up with a boy I didn't fancy on top of me. I was taken advantage of so many times. And then grown men, true strangers, overpowering, trespassing. I left my body and other people entered it. The real ways I was assaulted were not, and will never be okay. Now I see how tragic and embarrassing this is, reading it over on this one small page. All I can wonder is, how did this happen? How did I let this go on? Where was Blair? I never said a word to the sorority girls I was with about the rape. That crowd wasn't as messy. I imagined they had better sense to never put themselves in such situations alone. So I didn't tell anyone, ever, until now. These were the things I drank to forget. I didn't drink for attention. I drank to disappear, to find relief. I drank to numb the pain I was in. The mysterious aches and ever-present pains. And the more I drank, the more I drank out of the need to erase what I had done and who I was when drunk. It was a vicious cycle, but it was no matter. The desire to drink as much as I could, as often as I could, stayed with me and did not let go for more than 20 years. New York. In the summer of 1993, I received a postcard in the mail at our home on Coventry Woods Lane. It said I could take summer classes at an acting school in New York City for college credit. My parents agreed to let me go, only because Katie was living in Manhattan and could keep an eye on me. I lived on 29th and 2nd in a grad student dorm that smelled of mildew and Clorox. The whole place was infested with tiny cockroaches. I had never seen a cockroach in person before, until one spun out of the toilet paper roll when I was ripping off a few squares. They hid everywhere, in the walls, under the bed, in the phone books. I was forever scared to open the yellow pages, terrified a little roach might shimmy out and find its way inexplicably straight to my mouth. The acting school was through the Column Theater and Studio in Chelsea. All the students were around the same age as me. One pretty redhead named Deirdre had been in a Cherry 7-Up commercial years before, and I was in full admiration. She was the first person I'd ever known who carried around a water bottle. Odd, but also sensible. She was ahead of the curve, clearly, as well as the only one who'd signed with a real modeling agency, Wilhelmina. She had big, glossy white teeth and freckles and was a full head taller than I. One night after class, we all went out drinking and spied Matt Dillon across the bar. I'd been in love with him since he played Dallas in The Outsiders, and like my childhood poster come to life, there he was, brooding, unattainable, absolutely gorgeous. Deirdre kept getting up from our table to walk past him, hoping he'd notice her. She was quite confident, but I knew I should stay put. I didn't stand up until I was ready to leave, and then I shuffled right past him, out of the bar, and back to my Rochi apartment. Still, I couldn't sleep. Something about seeing Matt Dillon in person had flipped a switch in me. I had a goal, to be the one at the bar who captured others' attention. After that summer, I returned to Ann Arbor for my senior year of college, but I was itching to get back to New York. I had to get closer to the energy I'd felt that summer. My aim now was clearer. I wanted to try to make it as an actor. 1 week after graduation, I moved to New York City. My mom helped me pack my Hartman suitcase with Blair embossed in gold lettering on the side. She snuck in a pink and blue cotton quilt, so old and thin, it was flat as a penny, found pancaked on the tracks. I have carried that blanket from house to house for more than 20 years. I passed the long winter nights tucked under that blanket, rereading every story James Toner had assigned me, and desperately wanting to be safe and successful, and near my mother. We wrote long letters to each other. She'd write that she missed me so much she'd go into my bedroom and put on my old clothes just to feel close to me. Sometimes we spoke on the black rotary phone, but only occasionally because I had nothing glorious to report. I only wanted to share achievements that would make her proud. The struggle would not be of interest. My sister Katie was just starting her career as a book publicist in New York, and we saw each other often, which helped our relationship. She showed me how to use the subway. She lived with a roommate in Murray Hill. For 2 nights, I slept on her couch, but we quickly realized we were not meant to be roommates. Ever. The plan was for me to secure my own room at the Parkside Evangeline, a women's residence subsidized by the Salvation Army, situated in the Tony neighborhood of Gramercy Park. A pre-war building with 17 floors, the Parkside felt like a college dormitory, with its tiny rooms and simple built-in wooden furniture. My room had a desk with a lamp, a small twin bed, and a shared toilet, which smelled of age and Lysol. It was good. No kitchen, which was fine, since I didn't cook. It wasn't far from the column, and I drank enough beer to keep my clothing snug. The larger truth was, I couldn't afford food if I wanted to drink, and I wanted to drink more than I wanted to eat. So I didn't eat. I was an evening regular at Pete's Tavern, the oldest standing bar in New York, right across from where I lived. Women got free chicken wings during happy hour, so I went there nearly every night for my small supper, where lots of men would buy me drinks. Not knowing what to order, I drank Bushmills, a drink Lizzie ordered. It took me that year to learn that amber alcohol was not for me, causing me to vomit and sway too quickly. I fell off bar stools and stumbled back to my room, but the people at Pete's Tavern always took some care of me. I always made it back to my own bed at the all-women's residence. There were a lot of decent bartenders there, and someone usually walked me home. My first week in the city, I found a palm reader on the street, next to a sign advertising her as both a psychic and a gypsy. She held my hands in hers, carefully studying the lines. I knew that whatever came next was utter BS. But a person holds a little power whenever you ask them to tell you what they see. She considered my palms. You will have a horrible disease, and you will die a horrible death, she told me, before concluding with, do not go overseas. Then she told me that if I gave her more money, she could lift the curse and reverse my bad fortune. I didn't go for it, but I told everyone I saw for the next week that I was going to die a horrible death. It wasn't even a good story, but I told it over and over, wearing my curse like a badge of honor. I gave myself 1 year to find some traction. At night, in my small wooden bed, I prayed for a miracle. I asked for clarity about what to do with my life. If a job didn't materialize, I'd have to give up, go back to Michigan, and work at Don's Donuts, then marry Rich, as if, in that fantasy, my mother would be pleased. In the meantime, I took a job folding t-shirts at the Gap on 75th and Lex. I loved folding clothes on the folding board. I loved the Gap pens we won if we sold the most product that day. I loved the employee discount and the tap of the register keys as I printed out gift certificates and ran exchanges. In a way, working at the Gap was the perfect job for me, a place to channel my deep need for organization. To get there, I rode the subway more than 50 blocks uptown. It was worth it to emerge from underground and find myself on the Upper East Side. That location was regarded as the first class of the Manhattan Gaps, attracting only the finest shoppers. I sold Valentino a stack of white t-shirts, the perfect pocket tee. He couldn't get enough. Then, after nearly 10 months of the struggle, Jana Kogan found me. One night while I workshopped some scenes for this children's agent, a blue-eyed pixie watched me from the velvet row seat where she sat holding her clipboard. She looked amused as I performed a botched monologue from Top Girls. I was wearing lingerie and too much lipstick, clutching a cigarette and a highball, and speaking in a wonky southern accent. At least that's what I was going for. The agent said that perhaps my headshot should be updated, and that was all. I recently asked her if she remembered the monologue. Her eyes danced. Terrible, she said with a laugh. Oh, with a horrible southern accent. I was pathetic, but promising enough for her to see some potential in me, because she called me the next day at the Parkside. On my pager, rather. I rang back. She was energetic and funny and encouraged me to keep going. Get some clothes, a new haircut maybe. She had no idea who I was, but we fell in love with each other. I needed a chance, and Jana is the one who gave it to me. She took me on, and we became a team. Jana signed me, then sent me out on auditions. I dressed in my wardrobe of pocket tees and shorts from the Gap, purchased with my employee discount. After 60 auditions, I was offered my first movie role, Cousin Linda, in a film called In-N-Out. $3,000 a week for the six-week shoot. I booked it. It was a golden age for movies. I was on set with Joan Cusack, Kevin Kline, Tom Selleck, and most exciting of all, Matt Dillon. The very one. The unbelievably model-gorgeous Shalom Harlow also made her debut as Matt Dillon's girlfriend. I remember watching her in the makeup chair, where she magically transformed from a pretty teenage girl with pubescent acne into a Hollywood beauty with clear skin and red lips. In the end, my scenes were mostly cut, but I didn't care. I'd been discovered. I had my first role, and I was now a hugging acquaintance with Matt Dillon. I was on my way. A perk of living at the Parkside Evangeline was the free daily breakfast provided in the basement for residents. While I lived there, I became friendly with a woman from Scotland who also lived and worked at the Salvation Army. One morning over breakfast, she told me about a tea leaf and tarot reader she frequented. The woman charged $250 for a reading, which for me at that time was quite the hairball to swallow. Still, I wasted no time seeking her out. The reader was an old Turkish woman who looked, dressed, and acted like a vaudeville character of a fortune teller. Every element of her home and wardrobe was straight out of central casting, right down to the Victorian furniture covered in plastic and the cat perched in the other room. Overall, the apartment was very nice, a spacious walk-up with wood floors and high ceilings. She read my tea leaves. Gazing into the bottom of her little porcelain cup, she said that I had a boyfriend who recently died and that he was with me. Immediately, I thought of Brad. She said I would be in show business and that I wouldn't do that well, but I would stick with it. She said I would have a little dog that would help me. Then she said that someone with the initials M.W. would be a very important man in my life, that I would come across him later in life, and that he would help save me. I looked for that M.W. everywhere. I always believed in it. The first job I got was on the series Matt Waters. I thought, there's the M.W. Finally, a prediction that came true. To take it one step further, Matt Waters was played by Montel Williams, another M.W. who became my friend. It didn't dawn on me until recently, but Montel has MS and has been a huge help in my life. I could never have known, when I saw that tea leaf reader, the turns our lives would take. Montel became a hero of mine, and I don't hesitate to say this prophecy was fulfilled. It was during this time in New York that I got my own place in Murray Hill and took up with a Cranbrook friend's redheaded stepbrother who I knew had a crush on me in high school. He was smart, complicated, and very fashionable. He took me to the Gramercy Tavern, Beach, Mezzaluna. He lavished me with gifts, buying me a new wardrobe at Calvin Klein, shoes at Prada, hats from Dolce & Gabbana. But the clothes did not change my essential character. Once we became a couple, a label he didn't seem to embrace, I drank even more, a cover for my insecurity. On my 22nd birthday, after a few too many dramatic arguments and hangovers, I admitted, I think I need to stop drinking. I arrived at both the conclusion and the confession out of necessity. He rewarded my honesty by leaving the bar with another girl. I was shook, devastated, crushed. In my acute panic, I rushed to self-destruction. I went back to my studio, where he often spent the night. I rummaged through his leather DOP kit and took all the pills I could find. I didn't actually want to die. I just wanted the pain to end instantly. I wanted comfort and revenge. I hated myself. I found my favorite Belinda Carlisle album and put on Mad About You. In a world with Belinda, I didn't want to die. I called his sister and told her what I'd done. She said to call someone I trusted, someone nearby who could help me. I had no friends in New York at the time, and I wasn't about to tell Katie, so I called a man whose business card I had, a photographer who'd recently taken nude photos of me for a project on alternative beauty. He came over right away, and the plan was to take me to Bellevue Hospital, which was right around the corner. I was adamant about not using my insurance, because I didn't want my mother to find out and disown me the way she had when I was in college. But my concern was premature. Just as we reached the entrance to Bellevue, I fell and passed out. My face hit the pavement so hard that I broke a bone, the zygomatic arch, just beneath my eye. The photographer picked me up, and instead of taking me into the hospital, he carried me back to my apartment. I don't remember in my mental state exactly what happened next. I don't know what was said or not said. I don't know what I invited. I don't know what transpired. All I know is that I passed out, and when I opened my eyes, he was having sex with me. I came to just long enough to understand that he was on top of me, with Belinda still playing in the background. And then I passed out again. The next day, Katie came over. We were supposed to have met earlier that morning for brunch, but I was so far gone, I never heard her pounding on the door. She persuaded the super of my building to let her in. When she came inside, she found me sprawled on the floor, mumbling incoherently. I was not well. After the drinks and the bottles of antidepressants, it was more than I could manage. Katie rushed me to the hospital, where they pumped my stomach again. The doctors told her I'd ingested a lethal amount, but I survived. There was a lot of damage done. physical and emotional. The hospital contacted my parents. We all agreed, out of necessity, that I would come back to Michigan and immediately enter an inpatient rehab facility in Pontiac. Rehab is a tricky thing. It feels a little like going to camp or to boarding school. You're with a bunch of other people who are as messed up as you. This particular treatment center was more of a state lockup. There was no way out. At Fox Center, my roommate was a toothless meth addict from Las Vegas. My closest ally was a man by the name of Bob Evans, no relation to the sausage family. A wheelchair-bound diabetic with blue feet and a winning personality. While I was in rehab, I fully owned that I was an alcoholic. It was absolutely clear to all of us. With the introduction of AA, I felt hope for the first time in my life. AA was a good tool at the time, though it became more difficult for me to maintain over the years once I became more recognizable, in part because I lost my anonymity. But back then, when I was unknown, the tools of AA forced rigorous honesty. On family visiting night, my mother pulled me into her lap, wailing, and cried, "Oh, my baby," over and over until the nurses told her that she couldn't have me sitting on her lap because it was inappropriate. But she wouldn't listen. She held me in the way I'd always hoped she would. And we were being separated by the staff. She seemed relieved that I was an alcoholic. "Oh, it explains so much," she said. It was a bigger comfort to her than thinking I was only depressed. Alcoholism, she thought, was something that could be fixed. At Fox Center, we were kept inside, the doors locked, smoking Newport after Newport in the kitchen lounge. I acclimated to various new prescription drugs, antabuse and Trexan mostly, ostensibly to curb any wish to drink once I was released. One morning, after a dose of Trexan, I felt especially agitated, rageful, upset, frightened. I was having my first panic attack. Earlier, my doctor, who was also a friend of my father's, had said I was welcome to read the Merck manual he kept in his office whenever I liked. This was a great comfort to me as a natural researcher and self-diagnostician. I was on my way to read about the side effects of Trexan when I encountered a nurse blocking my path to the doctor's office. Steadying my voice as best I could, I calmly explained to her that I felt out of control, triggered, trapped, distorted. "I've never felt this way before," I told her, adding that it must be because of one of the prescribed drugs in my system. She ignored me, then ordered me to class. I repeated my story. I moved closer to the doctor's office door, but she pushed me away. That was it. I lost control. I punched her in the back with all my confusion and anger. She did her best to block my blows until three big security guards rushed over, restrained me, and carried me to a small room where I was given a sedative injection. The doctors discontinued the Trexan. Poof, I was normal. My rage vanished. What I didn't know at the time was that my father had witnessed this entire episode. He had come to visit me and stood silently in the hallway, watching the scene unfold. Later, he would use that episode against me. While home in Michigan, shortly before my release from rehab, my father checked me out for the day to take me to the eye doctor for a checkup. I'd been having trouble with my vision and was experiencing some unusual pain. I hadn't seen my childhood eye doctor, Leonard Lerner, in several years, but he was the same. Thick mustache, kind face framed by round spectacles. I laughed, remembering how sweet he had been when I had to wear the eye patch as a girl. Now I was 22, thin and pale and agitated from weeks of rehab and antabuse and attempted starts on antidepressants. In the dark room, staring into my dilated eyes, he asked, "How is your vision? Do you see all right?" I thought for a second before replying,